Welcome to Emotional Sobriety. How's it going, Howard?
My check-in might be somewhat elaborate, so I'll condense it right now. But if you guys want to go on, I can do that. Just spent a week with family. So
well, you need to go on then, Howard. Please.
one of our favorite characters, Tom, was my mom. Was in the picture.
Yeah, I met her.
Yeah. And so, you know, we kind of made a little road trip. From here, if we were in New Jersey, we drove out. So we drove to Pittsburgh and then ended up in Columbus, Ohio. And with my wife and then our son met us. He's, you know, from Colorado. My mom and her husband drove out there from Illinois. And one of the primary kind of attractions, the reason we did this is because Thanksgiving probably was going to be difficult, both with flights and weather and everything like that. So we said, because I had time off from work, to let's meet somewhere and do something rather than go to Chicago, sit in someone's living room for 2 days and go home. So we went to Ohio, where the Columbus Zoo has an association with an outdoor safari type of thing, where you can get on and off and feed giraffes and feed rhinos and ostrich.
Cool.
Ostrich, I don't know what the plural of ostrich. We'll say ostrich. That's the plural. Yep.
A bunch of ostrich. Yeah.
And ostri.
Right. And if you make them leave, they're ostrich sized.
No.
Okay. Sorry for those of you listening. We have some dad jokes going on here. One of the things that, it was a daily hour by hour, dealing with, some of my past. And, one of the expressions I've really grown to love is, like, you know, I have so many GPS pins in the past, put in the past, and they just, they're there. And I go and visit them. And most of the, you know, this time I met them protected, I'll say, and educated, rather than visiting them, you know, completely unprotected and unaware of what's going on. So, my mom is now, she's 81, she'll be 82 soon. And, you know, the idea that anything would change would be naive on my part, and really offensive. Because I know better. I just know better. Mm-hmm. And through the observations, you know, what happened for me, I guess, is I had to digest and grieve this woman who, you know, because we don't see each other, you know, months at a time. So, I mean, I've seen her for a year. And so the degradation of her health is much more obvious, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, her decline, and one of the key things that I think was so sad, and I'll get a little worked up about it, is, you know, she has a COPD, and she's had it for, I'm sure, quite some time. But we decided to take a walk, and the walk would have been 15 minutes, you know, and we get, you know, we're going basically halfway up the block, and she has to stop. She just can't catch her breath, you know, and her husband's trying to do the best he can. And my wife is actually being kind of a huge support, and both for her and me. and herself, you know, she's just much more attuned. Like her mother before she passed was kind of infirmed like this. And so in a way she's done this before, you know. I think in the last episode you guys were saying, you know, we've seen this movie before. Look, I could go into some of the little antics and, you know, inappropriate things. And it's like, And you know, there's a saying, it's like, well, she's old now. Yeah, but it's been this way for 50 years, you know, or 30 years. And it's like, it's the same thing. Yeah. And it's not going to change. Like, there was a chance it could change, and it's not. And I don't mean that in a bad way.
No, it's real. You're talking about just realistic. Yeah, I get it.
Because I used to work at a, when I lost my job, you know, as if like I woke up like, oh my God, where's my job? No, when I got fired from a job.
Where did I leave it?
What's that?
Look under the cushions.
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah. So I decided to work at the local grocery store because I just couldn't sit around and watch, you know, reruns of Law and Order so many times. And I had to do something and be productive. So here I am, I was scanning groceries, you know, with a bachelor's in chemistry, and, you know, I'm working 30 hours at the grocery store, and this is my life today, you know. So one of the things that would happen is I worked like the morning shift during the week, and quite often someone in their 80s is shopping and they're coming through, and God, sorry.
No, take your time.
I get so upset when I think about this. So I'm scanning groceries, sir, you know, and they're like standing on the cart, and the cart's the only thing holding them up, you realize. And the person behind them is huffing and rolling their eyes and trying to look at me. And I'm like, you know, they know they used to walk better than this. So if you think you're impatient, imagine how they feel day in, day out, knowing they haven't always been like this.
Most of them.
You know, and I just want to say something to people, you know, go F yourself. Because
no shit.
You're next. Do you think you won't be, you know, like this in your 80s or whatever age? You know, you think you won't age, you know? So that was real eye-opening. That was back in 2009 when I thought I knew everything, right? 20 years of sobriety. And I just like got, you know, so now fast forward, here we are with my mom. And I'm like, you know what? She also knows she used to be able, she could walk 15 minutes without a problem. She also knows she could do so. I have to help her grieve also, you know, and there was one time where I had to say, you know, she started to kind of push, I'm fine, I'm fine. I said, Mom, I love you and you're not fine. You're struggling. And I said, you know, I've done enough work in sobriety that if you push me away, I'll take a walk and you'll be on your own. I'll come back, but I'll excuse myself in an appropriate way. I said, do you want me to leave you by yourself? I won't feel guilty. You know that. And she's like, fine, stay.
You're a choice. But, and she, you know, I didn't know it was a real choice.
I said, here's the reality. You're not okay. And I love you, even though, you know, and a lot of moments like that. Now, the upside, again, this is like another incredible piece. So her husband is, you know, he's not my dad. I don't know how long, years married, but they've been together 20 years at least. Mm-hmm. And so, he's a big hockey fan, and we went to the Columbus Blue Jackets hockey game, and I bought us tickets in the club level area where they give you food and drink and everything. We got an Asian salad, you know, at a hockey game, you know, with the crunch and the peanuts and the, so to see him, he wouldn't normally get seats like this, even if he went to the Blackhawks or something. Mm-hmm. And just to see him light up and be there. So like was again, a wonderful moment for me where I was like, oh, I'm not here for me at all. You know? And there were a lot of these moments when we went to the zoo and my wife was feeding the giraffe and my son was petting a rhino. And I'm like, I'm not here for me at all. Like, and I say that because so many times I don't want to go somewhere because, well, it's, what am I going to do? Nothing. You're going to be there for somebody else. You're going to observe somebody else enjoying themselves and contemplate what that looks like rather than what isn't it for me? You know? I'm bored. Yeah. Well, you're bored because you're boring, you know? Or there's nothing wrong with being bored.
Right.
You know, so I had a lot of moments like that as well, you know, but the reality is I need to sit down and have a pretty good cry at some point in time. Because it's there. It's all there. I feel it. I'm very aware of my body. Like it just.
Oh, I can see, you can see it in your whole, even through Zoom, I can see it and feel it. Yeah. It's powerful.
And it's there. And we had a 8-hour ride back home, right? So it would be broken up into like 4 and 4. But normally like, oh man, God, what do we listen to or whatever? You know, my wife and I spent that first 90 minutes back home just decompressing, you know? And it took that. And it's still decompressing, you know. And what I guess, you know, the message I have here today is, and I don't know if I used this the last time, but, you know, you may be done with the past, but the past is not done with you.
And, I love that.
And here it is. And I can deal with it bit by bit in a healthy way, talking to healthy people, crying, contemplating, And it may take 2 weeks to get this all out. You know what I'm saying? Like people are like, oh, I should be over it by now because I'm saying, you know, this is pain from years and years and years. And I've recovered from it. I was a much better son than I ever have been. I had some moments where I was rude and I was short and much better than I ever was. So I feel pretty good about that. And it's still there. It's still there. And what I need to be aware of is when I get up tomorrow morning and go to work and I work with teenagers, that I have to set aside what's going on with me. Because that is one of the places it's going to come out, is at a you know, snarky teenager, right?
Sure.
And, or at an adult behaving like a teenager, you know, and... So again, I sit here telling you guys that when I wake up tomorrow, like that is going to be part of my meditation. It's like, okay, you're still grieving, stupid. Okay. don't think for one moment that work, you know, oh good, here's my work day and it's a great distraction, and it is, and it's still there. So, please, you know, I have to, you know, take my time. And you know, this emotional sobriety piece, because I, you know, because between that book and what we talk about and some other literature I've been kind of getting into, is it's all about awareness of myself and other people. And, you know, I think this is the first time that I acknowledged that, you know, my mom was also grieving who she used to be, you know, just 10 years ago, you know, 72, she was walking, she was doing fine, you know, so... you know, then this is really an exponential decline for, it'll be that, like that for all of us though. I oh, that's not going to happen to me because I eat right. Like, no, you know, it's going to, and hopefully I can remember that I need to grieve that. And, you know, that when I don't feel well about myself, I'm pretty hard to be around, you know, I'm not that much different from her. Right. She was all her defense mechanisms were there and they weren't personal. Yeah. They were like, I don't want my son to see me weak. I don't want my son to see me infirmed. You know?
A big leap forward at some point for you probably was recognizing that you need to allow space for that grief, you know, in the effort for emotional sobriety, alignment with what is. Some kind of balance, you know, the grief is going to be ongoing. So rather than just kind of like sucking it up and, you know, just grinding on, letting it be a part of the overall flow, right? That's kind of how I'm looking at what you're talking about.
Yeah. And so the statement I like to say is like, your grief is hard and not grieving is hard. So which, you know, when I say not grieving, you know, acting out and being, you know, doing all sorts of, you know, lousy sarcasm, you know, using sarcasm and all sorts of things to defend myself. And I mean, we can get to
avoid everything, which is avoiding everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah. So that's hard also. So I got to pick my, which path of difficulty I would like, you know,
That's beautiful. Yeah. Howard, this is a wonderful, to me, this is a, you're a wonderful example of something that that I can be giving myself a talking to about, or clients or whoever. It's like that, the idea that, you know, you don't get to that place where you brush your hands off and say, well, I'm glad I took care of that. I mean, that's when I was really younger, I did that a few times. And, you know, and we all know that, you know, that sharp pain in your ass that comes right after that. It's like, but because people always want to know, when does it get better? And I go like, I don't. That's a tough question. It's like when does it change? Well, it changes if you change, as you change. And so you're telling a story of a recovering person walking through. You know, I always say the holidays are like, you know, where you go home for therapy field work. You know, just in case you forgot where you got crazy. You know, go home, hang out. You know. And I used to have one client that they would book an appointment to come straight from the airport when she got back to Nashville. She would have her suitcase with her when she came to my office. So smart. She could talk about decompress. But yeah. I mean, it's, and it, well, you said it though. I mean, I would just be repeating you. It is about awareness, and we, you know, I think we've learned so much of that. I learned so much of that from, I mean, everybody, but from Roger Andes in particular on the Thursday night group, just that awareness and acceptance are beginning points, not ending points, you know, and your awareness of this, I'm doing it with my hands. It's just like, it's just expanded. I mean, you're just aware of so many different things, and you're making your decisions as you go along. And it's like, it is what it is. This is one of the things I bitch and moan about a lot sometimes when we have that question, how is your emotional sobriety? Like, we could put a dipstick in it and pull it out and see where it was. It's like, you know, emotional sobriety is a practice. You know, the better question to me is, how's your practice? You know, and that's a story about a person who's in doing their practice on a day-to-day basis. You couldn't have done that if you weren't in a daily practice before, all the time, while you're working recovery. But that's a really beautiful story of somebody with a good practice of emotional sobriety, really holding. One of the things Alan would say was holding on to yourself, you know, and it's beautiful. I mean, yeah, you couldn't have made that shorter. I mean, that's all. Everything you said was absolutely essential.
I've got advice, by the way, for anyone who's impatient with the older infirm. You should break one of your legs or have it broken and walk around on that for a little while, or attempt to. And then you'll get a sense of, you know, what it's like to be a little bit off center as far as your physical capacities. And then when you happen to be at a crosswalk and somebody's crossing in front of you at the speed of a turtle, you know, you can take a breath and just recognize that we'll all be hobbling along someday, and yeah. we should be kind to one another.
So I'm going to add something to that, Patrick. That's great advice. And let's say you've obviously healed from your injury, right? But let's say you were just healing, you know, you're wearing long pants and you got your leg wrapped up. I have no idea. And you're walking through the crosswalk. You're not really, but you're recovering. You're still recovering and you can't walk as fast. But I, from the outside, I'm like, what's wrong with him? He looks young. Can't he move faster? And it's like, you don't have a sign on your back. I just finished PT from breaking my leg. And see, I make up a story that says he's young and you know, I need to be somewhere and he's in my way. That's the story I'll make up. Or I could make up the story that, well, maybe he just finished PT and he can't walk as fast, right? I mean, understand chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder. And I say it out loud because it's chronic. It's not acute. It happens over time. Obstructive pulmonary. She can't breathe. I mean, I don't know if anybody's ever like been like, you catch your breath, you can't, but like, that is the one fear of like, I'm going to die. Like your whole nervous system, you know, the lizard brain takes over and it's like, this is it. And she goes through that every fucking day.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
It's so, you know, the other thing I'll bounce off what you're saying, Howard, is, you know, I never thought about it just this way, but it's like, if we're human beings, and the truth is, I mean, if somebody claims that they no longer make assumptions, then I'm going to say, well, I don't even know how you get through the day, because, you know, but it occurred to me as you said that if we're going to make assumptions, we can make better assumptions. Yeah. It's like, and you're describing assumptions that basically give people the benefit of the doubt. It's like, hopefully I don't need that explanation, but if I need an explanation of why that may be, why don't I give myself one? Because you're right. How many times have I given myself an excuse to be pissed off because I made up a story about this person, you know, walking slow at me? You know, it's like, I'll show this guy in the car. I'm just going to go walking really slow. It's, but I love that. It's like assume that there's that's one of the things I've learned when I learned how to not be a road rager or yelling at people in traffic and all this other stuff was just, you know. So these days I still talk to traffic, but I'll say stuff like, well, honey, who taught you how to drive, man? It's like, you know, it's like, try to move, scooch over there a little bit.
I was going to say like a Dolly Parton voice.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Dee pointed out to me, you know, years later, she said, you still talk to traffic. You talk to them nice. It's like, you know, she used to say, you know, if they knew who you were, then they would pull over and ask your advice. It's like, you know, that kind of, but no, I love that. I love that, what you're saying about that assumption. I'll take that into my check-in, because we all match up pretty good today. I'm on the other side. I'm way on the other side of my cancer treatment. I've had my second PET scan. No, there's no sign of cancer in blood work or anything else. And I'm, you know, but the cancer was not, the cancer's not a problem. Cancer treatment's a problem. It's like, that's what I've learned from this. And it's like, at least the kind of cancer I had is, that's the truth. And, one of the doctors told me when I went into the process of that, he said, do you exercise? And I said, yeah, I do. And, I told him what I did. And he said, well, you need to keep that up, because he says, you're going to lose muscle tone with this. And he said, you know, and he pointed out, he said, you've never experienced it this way, because when you're 70 years old, it's not that easy to get it back. So he was, the reality check was, you know, even though I'm really 35 years old and he just didn't know it, but he was pointing out that my body was 70 years old. And so I'm at that place right now because I didn't keep exercising, because, man, that fucking radiation shit took it out of me. I was on the sidelines. I tell you what, one of the things I'm doing with this conversation, Howard, is just feeling gratitude in the contrast with your mom, because I, you know, at my age, at my level of health, I can come back from the problems that I'm having right now. I have that opportunity, and I'm working on getting that motivation to do that, but I am having an experience with what it is like to be older. It's like, we got a dumpster out in front of our house, and we're doing, you know, big house cleaning. That's fun to do, the big purge, you know, get everything. And what I've noticed is as I carry stuff out there, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, I mean, I have to take these very frequent breaks, you know, and some of the time I just need to go lay down and take a nap. It's like, you know, and it's, you know, I enjoy doing that, but it's like, I realized, man, I'm just a short time ago, I was much better. So I like the idea of using these experiences as lessons in humility, which is what we're all talking about. It's like, no, let's realize that, you know, and also just the idea of quit making ourselves special, and realize, you know, as you were saying, Howard, everybody's going to get there. You know?
Yep.
I'll finish with this. Have you all seen the last Rocky movie, the one that Sylvester Stallone called Rocky Balboa?
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it, see it, because it's, if you loved the first Rocky movie, regardless of what you thought about the other ones, this is the bookend to that. It looks the same as that movie. The quality is exactly the same. It's a beautiful movie, and it's a movie about growing older. And there's one scene in there. If you haven't seen it, you'll notice it. Where he's once again gonna box. He's Sylvester Stallone is well into his 60s at this point, but the character Rocky was in his 50s, and he's gonna box this young guy. He's the champion. And so at the beginning of the match, when they come out in the middle of the ring, touch gloves, the young guy says to Rocky, he says, "You're a crazy old man," and Sylvester Stallone says, "You'll get there." I mean that was the best fucking line in the whole movie to me. It's like, you'll get there, and it's nice to know, you know.
Yeah,
but I'm doing good. I'm processing that stuff with you know, I got to get back in shape, and you know, it's not easy. It's work, and I need to do it, and it helps me just to say it out loud to you guys.
As my briefest of check-ins, I'm building furniture with my girlfriend, and it's terrible.
You're what?
Building furniture.
You're building furniture.
Building furniture.
Mean like putting it together, like?
Oh yeah, like, not like in, you know. It's by far
like you're a woods craftsman. You're designing a new. Okay, I got it.
Well, I wish there was some artistry or grandeur to it, but it's really just these giant heavy boxes that I can't lift on my own with all these panels and little tchotchkes and stuff that we're putting together. And anyway, what you said about humility, Tom, is it's helped me a little bit, at least, to just cards on the table to say a few times, I'm not good at this. I'm terrible. And it's very confusing. It's mental. The process of looking at all of these like pieces just spread out like like a model plane or like a jigsaw puzzle, and then trying to figure out how to put them all together. I mean, my brain is just not good at coordinating something like that. And so we're on day two of building this cabinet, and it's very, very frustrating. And it's the kind of thing where it's the size of it. It's gargantuan. It just fills the living room of the studio that I'm in right now. And, everything has to be put on hold pretty much until we can find a way to like raise this thing and try not to crush ourselves or one of the dogs or to crush that's the other risk that we're running, is that like if we lift it wrong or drop it or something, then it smashes to pieces because it's made of this like whatever, even foam. I don't even know what it's made. Not real wood, but kind of like a
particle wood.
Yeah. So I guess, yeah, emotional sobriety is not saying anything mean or stupid in the process of getting from A to Z on building this thing, and then actually building and succeeding in the project. But yeah, I mean, I had to say a couple of times yesterday that I needed to check my attitude, because I was not in a good mood while we're doing this, and I've got to do more of it today. So I don't know. It's my very like surface level restless, irritable, and discontent that the most emotional sobriety practice will hopefully come to for me.
Well, and it's a good one. I have a practical question. Is she good at it?
Well, better than me. She's a little better than me.
Because that's just a different way we have different brains. I mean, it's like, I'm making an assumption. I'm making up a story right now that Howard is good at this, right? Howard, if he had you to help him, you would get through it pretty quickly.
Well, Alex, so I'm good at reading instructions. I'm very good.
Oh my God, something's wrong with you. It's like,
And I'm also very good at giving instructions. So,
well, that's good. You could read the instructions and instruct Patrick what to do.
That's perfect. That's the problem. I think that's sometimes a yes.
The giving of instructions doesn't always match up with the reading of the instructions.
It doesn't go over that well.
No. So here's, you know, when, I don't know if I ever said this on the pod before, but like I used to have this joke, when you tell me a story like that, oh, so, yeah, that's actually in my recent book, How to Load a Dishwasher with Your Wife and 20 Other Ways to Fuck Up Your Relationship. Mm-hmm. Right. So again, you're doing something together where you probably both feel incompetent, mm-hmm, for whatever reason. And maybe you are, mm-hmm, and sit there and laugh about it. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe we can't put a fucking cabinet together. What?
Right.
And well, smile.
Yeah. Well, yeah. One way I'm trying to look at it is that, and it's the same way I look at this podcast, or I look at like other aspects of my life, is that like the big thing that you're dreaming of doing, right? You need to be able to do the little thing as well as you do the big thing before you could do the big thing well. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to look at this thing as, well, I would like to be with this person long term and do harder things. So if I can't do a fucking cabinet right, how am I going to be able to? And yeah, so it's all, everything's a test. Everything's on the same continuum, you know? And so I got to try and do this reasonably well.
Take your time.
Well, yeah, but more importantly, in my opinion, this is my opinion, but more importantly, what you're saying about checking your attitude, you need to do well. It, you know, it ultimately doesn't matter if you ever get any good at putting this shit together. You know, I mean, for one thing, I don't think you have any career aspirations that are going to call for you to do that. I don't think you have your you shouldn't have your self-esteem attached to how well you do that. I'm a big believer that, and it took me a while to get this, but we get to choose our sources of self-esteem, you know, because I used to feel so bad about myself that everything I was bad at, I would focus on, you know, and it's like, then I realized most things I'm bad at, you know, that I'm legitimately not good at, I don't care. You know, like when I had jobs in hospitals and stuff, I was always in trouble for how I took case notes. I mean, I just never did it right. I never did it the way, I was always in somebody's office, you know, them giving me a lecture about this. There was, you know, I was always late doing whatever it was I was doing. I was always late doing it. And that was around the idea that time I got the idea that, wait a minute, I don't care if I'm any good. Now, you know, I care if in that situation I was seeing clients, I care if I'm not doing a good job with my clients. That matters to me. That I take self-esteem from that. But paperwork, all I need to do is do enough to not get fired. You know, and so those that made so much of a difference for me. And I think it's made a difference for clients I've shared with. There's, you know, in the ultimate litmus test is this. You go to your own funeral. You become a ghost and you go to your own funeral so that you can eavesdrop on people talking about you. And you figure out, what is it I would care about when they're talking? If somebody, if I overhear you guys, you know, you guys are at my funeral and you're going like, you know, that was a scatterbrained, disorganized motherfucker. You know, I'm going, well, very observant, those boys. You know, it's like, I don't care. It's like, if you said, you know, we were in this process together, we did this stuff. And I never had the sense that he gave a shit about me. It's like, I got a problem. Okay, now I got a problem. So those are the things we need to be focusing on, are the things that would matter when we're dead. It's like, and the other things, yeah, we got to get them done, but that's all. You know, that's my thought.
Yeah. To me, when it comes to something like this, it's like, make sure you're more committed to your girlfriend than being a cabinet builder.
There's your nutshell right there, buddy.
That's splendid advice.
That's your bumper sticker.
Because you are an amateur at that.
That's probably what they told Joseph, right? The OG carpenter.
That's right.
We have a very brief grapevine article that we could do round robin reading and then just chime in on it before we sign off today. The Guy Who Ruined My Meeting, from November 2024, by Robin W.
He's new, he comes in late, and he disrupts everything. Someone should do something. I find my seat at the front of the room early as usual. I have long-term sobriety and still regularly attend meetings, most often here in my home group. The speaker starts to share and I'm instantly hooked, connecting and identifying with the speaker's story. I'm wholly absorbed, listening with rapt attention. And then Keith, new to the group, loudly shuffles in, late again, jostling past me in the crowded room, the oversized bag he's dragging around hitting me in the head. By now, the speaker's spell is broken and I'm furious with this inconsiderate guy who has once again ruined my meeting. Keith continues to show up late, meeting after meeting, and I obsessively rehearse in my mind what I'd like to say to him. Being a good AA, quote, I know I need to practice love and tolerance, but this guy who's disruptive to the, but this is a guy who's disruptive to the entire room. I mean, isn't it for the good of the group that he's not such a distraction? I pray for God's will and remind myself that it's okay to think like a jerk. I just can't act like one.
I'm going to celebrate 25 years sober, and Keith overhears me telling the meeting secretary I'll be taking a cake the following week. Excitedly, Keith tells me that we share a birthday. He'll be celebrating 1 year, and he asked me to present him with his cake. My heart softens a little for this stranger who I've made into my nemesis. Of course, I'll give you your cake. It would be my pleasure, I hear myself say. Not at all what I had been planning to say to this guy who's been driving me nuts. The next week, Keith shows up early to the meeting wearing a suit and tie. This is a first. I mumble under my breath. The time comes to celebrate birthdays, and he's up first. I present Keith with his 1 year cake, and he's beaming at me with pride and gratitude. He explains from the podium that it's been a tough year for him. He has been undergoing brain cancer treatment and waiting for a necessary hip replacement, which is on hold until his body is strong enough for the surgery. He adds that he rides his bicycle to the meeting in terrible pain, But even that's getting harder for him. Yet, despite all of these hardships, the caring and support he's found in the meeting has been his lifeline. And then he thanks me, and I am reduced to tears, my heart full of compassion and humility.
It's been 4 months since Keith and I celebrated our birthdays together. I hit a 25-year milestone in my sobriety that day, but more important, I was reminded of my primary purpose and why I practice AA principles in all my affairs. The best part of this story, I now drive Keith to the meeting each week, ensuring we both get there on time.
Man, that's just a perfect example of the idea that we were talking about before, based on what Howard was saying, is if you're going to make assumptions, let's make some good assumptions. You know, that went opposite way. I mean, I could identify with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I got a personal story on that when I first got sober. I'd like to share with you guys.
Please.
Cause I got sober. I'm 21, 22 years old, and going to meetings, as many as I can get to. And at one meeting I go to, it's like I'll say a noon meeting, something like that. And there's a woman there with a little baby, and of course the baby starts to make noise, and I'm trying to listen, and that baby's making noise. And I'm thinking to myself, boy, AA is not a place for babies. I'm like, oh really? Take a look around. But anyway.
The joke's too obvious, isn't it?
Right. It's like, who would bring a baby? We have enough. Anyway, so I'm getting all riled up and just, intense. And my sponsor happens to be there. And he says, and he knows how I'm doing, but he asks anyway. He's like, so how's it going? I said, fine. And he's like, yeah. Are you lying? I said, yeah. The lady with the baby, it disrupts the meeting. She shouldn't bring the baby. And he's like, oh, I see. Do you know about her? Do you know anything about her? I said, no. No. I said, I know she has a baby, because I'm smart. Like that I am. Yeah. He's like, she works two jobs. And she probably couldn't find a babysitter today. And this is the only meeting she can get to. And so if you have a problem with it, get to another fucking meeting, because she can't. Mm-hmm. And it just was like, he just walked away.
Love it.
And it's like,
tough love.
Ah. I see. I never had a kid. I never had. He's like, he was probably so disgusted with me. Like, who dare you? That was 35 years ago, right? Never forgot it. And now, someone comes with the baby, and I'm like, right. I hear the cooing.
I love babies.
Yep.
Maybe he was disgusted with you. But the other thing I'm thinking is, as old timers in the program, when somebody says something like that, is he also may have been just going, making another assumption. He may have been just going, this is being lobbed over the net for me. I know exactly what the response is to this. I just say this kind of tough love, harsh thing and walk away, you know, and my job is done for the day. So it's like, because sometimes it's just, and that's just one of those situations where it's obvious, you know, what the intervention needs to be. And I'll just tell this one quick. I was early in my recovery. There was this. I'm down here in the South. These are my biases. I'm. There's a guy sitting there eating pork rinds, and he's got he's sitting there wearing suspenders. By the way, these are my suspenders. It's like
they're smart looking.
That's what I described to my sponsor. It's like a suspender wearing guy, you know, and he just was sitting there chomping on pork rinds, and here's the short version. He said exactly what I needed to hear that day, you know, and I was thinking he was the most cliche. My main complaint was he was a fucking cliche of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, he was just, you know, he was quoting, he was had all the slogans down. He used them all in a paragraph. You know, it's like, it was that. And so my sponsor, you're talking about one of those things that we remember forever, Howard. I remember this. I will always remember this. I share it frequently with other people. It's like, he said, you have a choice. He said, you can judge that man, or you can take what he had to say that you needed, but you can't do both. And that was the tough love for me that day. And it's like, I chose, and I did too. I got it. I understood him, and I chose to take the wisdom that he said and realize, you know, that's the rest of that shit's not up to me.
I bombed out at one point in my life because of drugs and alcohol. And for those first couple of years, I couldn't believe when people said that one day I would have gratitude for having endured that. And I think that like a story like this, and then the work we do on the podcast, it really makes me think about my judgment, you know, my scathing judgment of others and other points of view. Yeah. And, you know, like that's something that I wrestle with. It's still very much a part of my existence, but I don't think if I hadn't been brought into contact with the Rooms of Recovery and kind of like this program, I would have never, I think I would have gone through my entire life with ever maybe even being aware of it or like coming in any kind of like contentious relationship with the judgy part of myself. And I think like I'm really glad that even though I don't always win the day, you know, or my better angels don't always win as far as that's concerned, that I love that these spaces really they force you to like have a kind of a greater compassion or empathy to your fellows and to kind of like break bread in a sense with all types of people that you know, don't agree with on a number of levels. But it's like it's one of the unequivocally great things about, 12-step recovery, about AA, about, you know, any kind of like fellowship organized around getting better from something, you know. So
absolutely. Labels, I mean, we're humans, so we do it all radically imperfectly, but you know, one of the things that we think about in recovery, or I was reading something by Anthony DeMello, who wrote many wonderful books. One called my favorite is his book Awareness. Another one that I'm reading now, rereading, is Awakening. It's like, he says it's always about awareness, is what he says, and just and part of that is letting go of labels. You know, everything, all the details. I'm a therapist. I'm a husband. I'm Patrick's friend. Just drop all your labels when you walk in here.
Well, Tom, I think it was an episode I heard you say one time, you were going on about something, a situation, and you said, you know, and I think it was this, you said the humility I need here is like, I don't think I have all the information.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, right. Even in right. myself, I don't have all the information.
Right.
Oh, so stop.
Right.
You know, making these conclusions based on, you know, facts not presented in evidence, Your Honor, you know, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And I would say also, when you said that, I think one of the places that that I've experienced that within myself and had to have been working on it, will work on it always, is as a therapist. It's like when you have, you know, one of the downsides of having, you know, 40 years experience of doing this work is you got a whole new set of assumptions that you're in danger of making. They're based on the experience with other people. You know, so I've seen, you know, somebody says something that reminds me of something that, you know, a dozen other people have said to me through the years and done that. And so if I'm not watching, it's unconscious, I'll click right in and I'll make that assumption. And I'm not going to get it at the time. I'm going to have to catch the assumption later and realize, wait a minute, because if I'm watching my client, listening to my client, I'm going to see where the communication misses, and then I'm going to go, okay, you got to go back. And because in communication, well, and we do this with our relationships too, it's like when somebody misses, when the communication goes sideways, most of us just plow ahead and try to make our position work anyway. Yeah. rather than stop and realize. I don't remember saying that exact sentence, but I like that sentence. I don't have all the information. And because the other thing I say to people in therapy when I give them experiments to do between sessions is, everything is information. There is no such thing as a failed experiment. You can try something. Information is all collaboration.
My dad used to say, and it wasn't his, but that's where I got it from. He says, can you call it the 3-minute rule? You walk up to a conversation and wait 3 minutes before you say anything.
I love it.
Because it's like, you just, well, you know what actually happened? Like, oh, you just got here. We've been having a conversation for about a half hour. And here you draw. So it's like 3 minutes, whatever it is, just like, you know, be, don't be in the center just yet. Be on the outside.
I love it. That's right.
Yeah.
Get a view of the field ahead of time. It works out very well with the scheduling, but I think next week on the pod, I would like to do something about the election. I don't know what. I'll have to get into the brain trust about that, but, yeah, emotional sobriety during a very fraught time, I think, could be good, and getting a guest on or something. So be on the lookout for that.
Emotional sobriety during a time where we're most people are emotionally soused.
I was going to say, thanks so much for coming, Howard. Really appreciate it. Yeah. And we love you, Alan. We'll see you again next week.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.